it's Diane. On my mind is taking a break this summer. But while we're away, we've left you with a special series, some favorite interviews with musicians from the Diane Rehm Show archive. Every Friday, we've been posting a new one. Today's is a 2004 conversation with renowned opera singer Renee Fleming. She talked about how she developed her voice into what became known as the gold standard of the soprano sound. For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. A woman steps forward on a stage as an orchestra plays an introduction. She opens her mouth and a beautiful sound flows out as easily as water from a crystal pitcher. The sound fills the entire concert hall as she stands relaxed and poised. It looks entirely natural, but that's not quite how it works. Acclaimed soprano Renee Fleming has written a book to offer a more accurate picture of how the operatic soprano sound is produced and how that woman gets on the stage in the first place. Her book is titled The Inner Voice. Renee Fleming is now appearing at the New York Metropolitan Opera House in Handel's Rotolinda. She's here in the studio with me. We'll hear some of her glorious music. What a pleasure to see you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So glad you could make it down. You performed last night, took the flight down this morning.
Exactly.
And you're going to be performing again Sunday night. Is that correct?
Oh,
or even
I think
before
it's,
then?
Yeah, I think it's Saturday night. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's not a bad week, actually, just too. But I was just here for the Kennedy Center Honors, and I had our opera's quite long. We finish at close to midnight.
I see. And that's Rotolinda.
Right.
Tell us about Rotolinda and why you chose it.
Rotolinda is a Handel opera. He wrote 40-plus operas. He was a very prolific operatic composer. So we don't know very many of them that well, but he's enjoying an incredible renaissance in the last several really decades. But it's heating up now because there are so many fantastic Handel singers and musicians and musicologists have shed light on this music to make it so much more modern and exciting than it was being performed even 30 years ago.
But why did you personally choose it?
Well, I had a huge success with Handel's Alcina at the Paris Opera, which we then brought to Chicago. And it wasn't just the fact that it was successful, because both the audience and the critics loved it. It was also that I decided that it's honey for the voice. It's the healthiest possible music for the voice.
When you say it's the healthiest for the voice, what do you mean?
It lies well. It's incredibly comfortable to sing. It's virtuosic. It's very difficult. It's not easy music, but it's virtuosic in a way that is not harmful to the voice. One can sing with great lightness and brightness and a lot of coloratura.
Thank you. René, you call this book an autobiography of your voice rather than the story of your life. Why that distinction?
Well, I had kind of, I hadn't really thought about it, but in from time to time it occurred to me that I wouldn't write an autobiography because, for two reasons. One, my story is not particularly unusual or interesting. And two, I'm not the greatest raconteur when it comes to fun anecdotes about other people or gossip or any of that. I'm terrible at that. What I am willing to do and what they said they wanted, Viking that is, which appealed to me very much, was a process oriented book about singing and about building a career. And in fact, if the template for me was, what would I have loved to have read when I was a Juilliard student? I would have, a lot of the information in this book would, of course, help me a great deal. It's my own story, though it's not meant to be a general how-to for any singer. Mm. It's very personal. It's a personal journey, but I meant it for both for young singers who could even get one simple concept from the book, and for audience members who've never been able to understand how we do what we do.
But at the very end of your book, you talk about what your job is like. You're warming up backstage at the Met, and there are cell phones going off right and left, and you're getting ready to sing La Traviata.
Exactly. And it's the kind of preparation which is very, you know, it's a high wire act really performing for us, because in the end of the day, every night we have to do things which are very unnatural. It's not natural to sing the way we sing. I call it a kind of a cultured scream in a way. For 3 or 4 hours at a time, most people would be completely hoarse.
Extraordinary to be able to get your voice to do those things.
Well, it really is. And, you know, I often maintain that the greatest singers in the world have no idea they even have a voice. It's the kind of thing that has to be discovered at some point. And very often, not in the way that I was discovered. My parents were both singers. So in a sense, I had no choice. Even if I had no voice, I would have still been coerced to sing as a child. But a lot of voices are discovered in schools and in church choirs, and somebody says, well, that's a special sound. I often hear someone speak on the street or in the subway, and I think that's an instrument. That's an extraordinary instrument, and I bet they don't even know it.
Well, how did it begin for you? How did you begin to believe in your own voice?
Well, I first believed in music. I always loved music, and it eventually became my own when I discovered composition, when I started writing my own music, and I was such a shy teenager. I needed that really as an expressive outlet to communicate with anyone. And then I discovered pop music. I discovered jazz in college, and eventually what really excited me about classical music was a practice room, almost a religious discovery, was being in the room alone with my voice and trying to understand it and trying to make it function. These are all involuntary muscles. So imagine that you're trying to get the various organs and muscles in the inside of your body to function, but you can't do it with your mind. You have to do it in a roundabout way through imagery and through imagination. It's an extraordinarily interesting thing to try to accomplish.
When did the actual lessons begin?
The lessons began very relatively soon. I mean, in junior high school, I was taking lessons in the continuing education department at the Eastman School of Music. But they didn't really begin in earnest until, and my parents always taught me. My mother is and still is a wonderful teacher, and she every time I had to prepare something, she was there working with me. But when I went away to college was when I began to really get serious about the art of singing.
There's one role that finally put your career on track, and that was from Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. What happened there? How did that begin to work its way into your magic?
Well, I think it was a wonderful coincidence that as my career began, we were in the Mozart year, which was in 1991, I think, bicentennial. And it was such an extraordinary, there was an extraordinary need for singers of this repertoire. And the Countess, which was the role that I sang and debuted in almost every major opera house in the Western world, was the role that was difficult to find singers to fill, because it's such a terrifying role to sing. And in fact, I don't really sing it now. I haven't sung it for a long time because I thought, I've done that. I've paid my dues. It's so terrifying to get on stage and have to sing this aria.
Is so terrifying.
Mozart requires perfection, nothing less than perfection. Perfect line, clarity of tone, beauty of tone, dynamic control. It requires absolute control of the voice, and it very often, at least in my repertoire, sits in a very uncomfortable place, in a place that makes you really want your throat want to just close.
Really?
Yeah, it's called the passaggio, which is a passage, a transition area between the middle and the high voice. It's challenging, extraordinarily challenging. The hardest thing of all for me is that it's so exposed. The orchestration is very light. One feels completely naked on stage and exposed in a way that is provides a sort of vulnerability in a way.
In a way that doesn't happen in other
opera. Repertoire, absolutely, yeah. For me, I mean, other people, actually, I can say for me, but truthfully, I know most sopranos really think, oh my gosh, the Countess. It's extraordinarily difficult.
But you took it on.
Well, it was my chance. It was my opportunity. And it wasn't particularly a chosen one. I would have chosen easier repertoire. But that was, the doors were opening as a result of this role. And I'm grateful now. 10 years of Mozart gave me a solid foundation technically. If you can sing Mozart, you can sing anything.
An email from Richard, who's in Indianapolis. Would Ms. Fleming discuss the progression of roles as the voice matures and how often she can perform without running the risk of injuring her glorious instrument?
Well, in terms of repertoire throughout one's career, it's very often the case that the voice gets a little bit lower and deeper and richer, and people then take on heavier repertoire. My situation has been exactly the opposite. And I think that's because as my technique has improved, as I have become a better singer, my really healthiest natural voice has come out, which has been higher. So I moved from, my repertoire didn't change exactly, but I added repertoire such as Manon and the bel canto repertoire, singing it a little bit easier, Traviata, that I couldn't have sung 10 years ago, interestingly enough. I would be surprised if at this point I'm going to see my repertoire get heavier and weightier. But if I'm still singing in 15 years, it certainly will. What was the second part of the question again?
Whether you run the risk of injury.
Oh, injury, yeah. No, then we don't sing. Think of us as weightlifters. We can only perform every other day at the most because the strain and the stress on such a tiny instrument and such tiny musculature is so great that we would indeed run the risk of injury if we perform more often. We are not, I always like to remind people, we are never amplified, except maybe in a stadium concert, but we are the last remaining singers in the Western world, and even street performers have their little PA systems they carry around. We are never amplified.
So you have to count on your instrument plus the shaping of the auditorium,
the hall,
to carry that voice.
But it's a technique of projection, of learning how to use the instrument in the most efficient way so that we can project to the back of the hall.
One place that you had difficulty was in your auditions. You finally had success with a piece from Dvorak.
Right, the song To the Moon.
Why?
Well, I think everyone has an optimal repertoire, has an optimal a piece that speaks to their heart. It wasn't well known at the time, so I think it was in a sense also not only a good marriage for me, but was something interesting also for the adjudicators, something different for them to hear. And I sang it in Czech. My family is Czech. And it gave me, that aria is a thread that has run through my entire singing career, because it not only gave me my first opportunities, but it gave me it gave me high notes in a sense. And you know, through working on it, I discovered incredibly crucial aspects of my technique.
But did you doubt that the judges would like this piece?
Oh, I always doubted that they would like anything. I mean, I felt like the original invisible girl when I was auditioning and apologizing my entire way into the room. It took me a long time to learn how to audition well. In fact, the Murphy's Law is that when I became good at it, I no longer needed to do it.
You no longer had to audition.
Right.
Because you were accepted.
I was getting there.
What was it you had to learn about yourself and presenting yourself?
Well, I see this now when I give master classes. As a young singer, we're so caught up in the voice and in singing and in the performance, and we imagine that every note will be critiqued and judged. But the truth is, we as an audience, and judges are audience members as well, want to be touched and moved and inspired. We want a performance. And it's almost impossible for young singers to get beyond that and show their personality and show who they are. So I ultimately had to sort of pretend I could do that, and then it began to happen.
That's fascinating. You had to pretend to yourself that you could do what you had to do. And in so doing, you convince the judges.
Exactly.
Here's an email from Chris in Cincinnati, who says, is there an age where you believe one is too old to begin a career in opera?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. I think for really extraordinary talents, one will make room, particularly in the larger repertoire. We seem to have many, many lyric voices for Baroque repertoire, for Mozart, and for the lighter repertoire. But for Verdi and Wagner, it's more difficult. So certainly in that repertoire, there are people who've been accountants. There are people who've had completely different careers and who suddenly at the age of 32 say, I'm going to try and sing. And they're welcome with open arms because we need their voice, their particular voice. It is difficult, though. Without extraordinary gifts, it would definitely be difficult. Like all of the performing arts, there is now a focus on youth, beauty, on looking the role. We're much more of a visual society now, and that's translated also into the performing arts a great deal.
How do you think that emphasis on youth and glamour and beauty might affect your own career?
Well, it's affected me insofar as that I've certainly worked on those elements in my performance. The idea is to give a total performance. My goal is to make the audience forget that I'm Renee Fleming and hope that they believe that I'm Rodelinda or Arabella or the Marshalin. And, you know, sometimes it's kind of, if you really step back and think about it, first of all, we ask the audience to suspend disbelief and imagine that we're speaking and not singing, because we're singing. Secondly, we ask them to suspend disbelief because most of the time I'm playing a young girl between the age of sort of 16 and 20. And fortunately, we're the last remaining art form that really, in which we can absolutely get away with that and be believable. Mirella Franey is Tatiana and Eugene Onegin in her 50s. We believed that she was 14, 15 years old because that's how she played it and that's how she sounded.
One last selection before we open the phones, and this by Rachmaninoff, the beautiful voice. Talk about this piece.
The Vocalese. Oh, it's one of the most haunting pieces ever composed. It comes into my mind a lot as something really that expresses the melancholy of certainly of Russian culture, which most of us adore. And it's extraordinarily difficult to sing. I didn't realize how much I loved words until I recorded this piece. Because that the simple act of words allows everything to continue to move and remain fluid. On an ooh or an ah, the possibility for tension is greater. But I love singing this piece.
The technique, the training involved here has got to be extraordinary.
It really is. Yeah, it's in most everything. The thing I love about what I do is that I'm singing the music of 400 years. Imagine the variety in my everyday life. It's extraordinary. Imagine being able to think about the human condition as it was described in art 300 years ago. Things haven't changed very much. That's always a bit of a shock, certainly between men and women.
And the fact that this music simply goes on is extraordinary.
That's why it's classical.
All right. We've got lots of callers waiting. Let's go first to Granger in Salt Lake City. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Pleasure to meet you, Renee.
Thank you.
I have used your videos in my classes. I teach enjoyment and opera classes at the University of Utah.
Oh, wonderful.
And you're an important part of the curriculum. I wanted to ask about Susanna. I saw the performance in New York 3 or 4 years ago with Sam Raimi and Jerry Hadley.
Mm-hmm.
You were wonderful. I remember you sitting on the roof and singing.
Oh, thank you.
The arias.
Thank you.
About the vulnerability word, my impression is that voices like Sutherland and Mofo and maybe Ruth Ann Swenson, they have a technically perfect gift or something. They sing quite the same all the time, and sometimes I see a look on your face that you're hoping to find the right voice for the coming phrase. Is this a purposeful vulnerability, or is it something that you're truly searching for in your voice?
So funny that you say that, because I sat down in the middle of the third act last night of Rodelinda and turned to my colleague Stephanie Blythe and said, I'm going crazy tonight. I'm obsessing over, I had just sung this third act prison aria, which is heart-wrenching. And I said, do you think I should maybe give it more variety? Do you think I should, she's in the scene with me. I said, I was wondering if it's too aggressive, if it's too this, if it's too that. I mean, this is the search that I'm on right now, is phrase by phrase and sometimes note by note, what's the optimum way to express the anguish of, or the joy or the love in any given piece. I'm constantly searching, because making a beautiful sound is only the beginning, and it's only interesting for about 5 minutes.
Thanks for your call, Granger. You know, he talked about perfection. We think of perfect voices, and yet, I mean, Maria Callas did not have a perfect voice. And yet, you know, through the years, people have sort of idolized her voice. What do you think it is about the search for perfection? You're doing it yourself.
Well, but the thing is, it's such a relative term. I mean, and ultimately, perfection is not all that interesting. And I, like everyone else, I sit in a house, and if somebody is struggling and they make it, that's more exciting than someone. And I'm criticized for this all the time, someone for whom it's obvious they're going to be fine. They're going to absolutely, and I keep telling people, the detractors who say, you know, it's boring because it's too good. I say, well, just give me a few years. I promise you I'll be in decline and you'll love it then.
Here's a piece. This is Casta Diva from Bellini. This is what brought to mind the whole Maria Callas thought. And I wonder what you can tell us about this piece.
Well, this piece is from the opera, Bellini opera called Norma, and it's one of the great standards by which sopranos have been judged over time. It's a great bel canto, a virtuosic opera in fact, the word Casta Diva, this is chaste goddess, diva, which is the word goddess, and she is, in fact, a high priestess. But Maria Callas made this role incredibly famous. There was something in her sound that just still breaks our hearts. And we know, of course, a lot about her life, too, and how tragic many aspects of her life were. But it's the expressive quality, I think, in her sound that we love so much. I do. And it's a little bit of an acquired taste because it's not immediately beautiful. But to me now, when I hear her, I think only beauty. I think of beauty because I love it. And there have been many artists in history who have captured our imaginations, and not always because they had such a beautiful or perfect instrument to begin with.
And what do you think as you're sitting here listening to your own voice?
Well, I can't be objective at all, so I hear everything. I listen, when I'm editing a recording, I'm forced to listen to it a lot to make notes and to try and make the best recording I can, and after that I really can't. It's difficult for me to hear them because I would redo them entirely, even 30 minutes later, probably after it's finished. I think it's that kind of drive and desire to improve on things that keeps me going and keeps me interested in what I'm doing. And I tend, I think like many, many performers, to never think it's good enough.
quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Renee Fleming.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District,
Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with opera star Renee Fleming. She joined me on The Diane Rehm Show back on December 7th, 2004. And we'll go right to the phones now. Your questions, comments for Renee Fleming. Let's go to Sally in Mystic, Connecticut. You're on the air.
Well, it is such a pleasure to get on this program, and Miss Renee Fleming has given me so many days of enjoyment at the Met.
Oh, wonderful.
When I have seen you, Miss Fleming, is I just can't stop crying to that voice.
Oh, thank you.
That's lovely.
Absolutely delightful, delightful days. Many, many performances.
Good.
At the Met. My only question is this. When you get on stage, you know, I'm a physician, I feel that in front of so many people, 4,000-seat auditorium, you have your blood pressure raising, your heart rate going about 140 a minute, and you are able to stand there and perform just like a miracle. It's the creative capacity that you have. How do you do it? How you don't get nervous and upset up in front of these 4,000 people? And as you said, there is no microphone and there is no loudspeaker.
Well, you know, I feel just like you do. I don't know how I do it. And in fact, I've had some terrible periods of stage fright. And that's one of the things that I really discussed very candidly in the book, because I thought it might help people to know that it's possible to go through a period that is so terrifying and come out on the other end and be able to perform again with joy.
Describe it for us.
Well, I went through a period where I really had decided to quit singing because it was just so miserable. It was such a misery to even imagine being on stage. And stage fright, that kind of stage fright, I wouldn't wish on anyone, because it's not just jitter, you know, sweaty palms and jitters. It's when, you know, every part of you is screaming at the highest possible decibel, I simply cannot walk on stage. I cannot open my mouth and produce a sound. Fortunately, and I said, I'm quitting. It's been wonderful. I've already accomplished more than I had set out to accomplish, and I'm going to get a nice teaching job. And I was lucky to be surrounded with loving, caring people and my own inner voice, and thus came the title of this book, was that little voice inside of me said, gee, you know, do you really want to give it up? You've really dedicated a lot to this, and it's something you really wanted. And I eventually, over a period of 8 months to a year, was able to overcome it. And it stays with me. I had another bout, a much milder bout of it a couple of years ago. One of the tricks, of course, is not to quit, is to keep going. But I'm with you. I don't know how I do it. It's pretty scary.
Laurence Olivier experienced exactly the same thing. Yes. He was off the stage for at least
seven years. And some, I mean, Barbara Streisand, 20 years. I mean, there are many artists who come to this conclusion that it suddenly, almost overnight, just becomes unbearable.
Here's an email from Heather in Baltimore, Maryland, who says that you, Ms. Fleming, were an inspirational role model for her in college, where she was a vocal performance major for 3.5 years. She then goes on, I switched my major at the last minute because I didn't feel I had the nature I saw in others exhibiting to get ahead, almost a step on anyone, cutthroat nature. Could Ms. Fleming speak to this? Has she experienced this?
It's so funny because I was very shy. I'm not a natural performer. I don't have a natural performer's personality, and I have two children. One of them does, so I know what it is. It's that wanting to be up front and be number one all the time.
How old is that child?
I have two girls, 9 and 12. She's 9.
And she's 9, and you know she's a born performer.
There it is. That's that performance gene.
There it is.
Exactly. I wouldn't say it's a reason to give up singing at all. In fact, some of the young singers that I was in schools with who were number one because they had that kind of assertion and belief and real, what Leontine Price coined in a masterclass, a natural performing arrogance. I didn't have it, and I eventually got there anyway through other means and through just wanting it badly enough. So I don't think that's necessary. I am highly competitive, but with myself, alone. I don't compete with other people.
This piece from Puccini's La Bohème became so familiar to those of us who saw and loved the movie Moonstruck.
Au Musette's Waltz.
Can still see the tears flowing down Cher's face in that movie as she sat at the Met with Nicolas Cage watching that opera. Does it do that to you, singing this?
Oh, sure. I want to be moved just like everyone else when I go. I want to have goosebumps and I want to have that thrill. It's the human voice and its greatest possibility in opera. I think it's absolutely exciting.
Absolutely gorgeous as well.
I was shocked. I was at a screening for Mike Nichols' new film, Closer, recently, and Mozart's opera Così fan tutte runs through the entire film.
Really?
There are so many wonderful film directors who love great music and still use it whenever they can.
But let's talk about your interest in jazz, which has been there right from the start. I gather you're coming out with a new CD in the spring.
Well, jazz was one of my great passions as a young singer. And in fact, I thought I would be a jazz singer. That's what was my dream. That's what I wanted to do. And it's sheer through coincidence that I didn't, because I was literally too afraid to move to New York City. It was that simple. A fork in the road, and I took the other fork. And I'm thrilled that I did now. But jazz has remained a hobby and a passion ever since. Singers, instrumentalists, and it's the music I listen to. It's I unwind to it. I ever since I started with Decca, I wanted to make one personal journey back to jazz singing, because I did sing in a club for 2.5 years when I was a college student, and I have done it this fall and will come out in the spring, and it's a mixture, a very eclectic mixture of music from jazz standards, some classical music, and even a couple of pop tunes, in a very intimate recording with great musicians, Fred Hirsch and Bill Frisell. I'm tremendously excited about
it. Are you at all concerned that your opera fans will somehow question your decision to turn?
Well, of course I am. I mean, I think that people who have followed me know that this is something that I really love. And if it's, and interestingly enough, a lot of people who love classical music also love jazz. what will surprise people is that I sing about an octave and a half lower than they usually hear me sing. And in fact, in the demos that we made up in starting this project, no one knew it was me. So it's not the kind of jazz singing I do on a recital when I simply stylistically sing a Duke Ellington song in my classical voice. It's a total departure.
Want to ask you about having children, because a number of people advised you to have children. Why and what difference did it make?
Well, it was only a couple of generations ago that opera singers chose between raising a family and having a career. One did not do both very often, because the demands of an opera singing career entail an enormous amount of travel. That is really the problem, and a dedication to the voice. So it was interesting to me when Sir Scholte and Renata Scotto and Joan Sutherland and such great singers said, have children. It will give you joy and balance in your life. And that has certainly been the case for me. And I've managed, the greatest luxury of success is choice. And I've managed to, my choice has been to sing less so I could be home more with the girls.
We can't let you go without hearing this. And, of course, Anne Paget's book, Patchett, Bel Canto, written really about you.
She used a lot of my recordings as a musical template, but she didn't know me or didn't have...
But you have come to know her.
Yes, and my greatest coup de grace was enlisting her help in my book, and you can hear her. A lot of the beautiful writing in the book is from her. She really provided all of the connecting material, and then I went through and spelled out all the nuts and bolts so it would be right. But we worked together on the project, and it was such a joy. I miss her. I'm in with Anne Patchett withdrawal now.
And I shall be in Renee Fleming withdrawal after I leave you. What a wonderful hour to spend with you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it so much.
Thank you so much. Renee Fleming, her new book is titled The Inner Voice, The Making of a Singer. That was opera star Renee Fleming. She joined me on the Diane Rehm Show back in December 2004. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Michael Kitt. Thanks for listening, all. Be well, stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.